KX93.5 FM. Here we are on Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Geer. I want to thank the radio station for having us and also our sponsor, New Vista Behavioral Health. I always like to set up the show by saying, why are we here? Well, I'm a sober guy. By some miracle, I didn't die. Lots of my friends did. They still do constantly. And somehow I felt like I was supposed to be on the radio. I didn't even really want to be honest. I just had this weird intuition. And then I did a radio interview for a concert we were setting up, a Rock to Recovery concert. And they were like, hey, we want a recovery radio show. I was like, I felt like I was supposed to do that. And here we are. And I'm super passionate about it because I'm in recovery. I'm sober. And this gives the opportunity in having this show to share our stories and let other people know that they're not alone. Because when you're out there struggling, you feel so alone. You feel so unique. They call it terminal uniqueness. Like, oh, nobody gets my life. My battles are so much different than yours and stuff like that. And in talking about it, in sharing, we find strength in each other. And that's really what we're here to do in this show, is to give each other strength, to learn ways to recover, to learn we're not alone, to get hope. And so what we do is we interview some rock stars, musicians, celebs, rad humans, exceptional earthlings who have overcome their demons, but not just to survive, which to me was like, when I was getting sober, I felt like I was going to be like a guy who came back from war. Like, hey, Jim, he didn't die. He's back from Vietnam, but he lost his legs. I thought that's what life was going to be like. But what we find is when we adapt these programs of recovery, we use these tools, we start listening and taking direction from people who have overcome and have had success. We as people transform and get into what I like to call the vortex of radness. So we're not like a guy who lost a leg in battle. We come out and we turn into people that are bigger, better, smarter, faster, more loving, more incredible than we've ever been. And that's what the show's here to do, to talk about that kind of stuff. So tonight, does it sound like I'm on a lot of caffeine? Because I'm not. I'm just excited. I had a little nappy poo before the show. But anyhow, tonight, I want to tell you guys, I'm so excited about this. So, excuse me. A lot of you know we do Rock to Recovery. It's like a music therapy thing. We use it to treat all sorts of people, you know, addicts, mental health, wounded warriors. And we got honored by this really cool other nonprofit called 10,000 Beds. They help give free beds, if you will, treatment programs to people who wouldn't otherwise get them. We, Rock to Recovery, got honored there. And there was a speaker there. And I'm going to be honest. I was like, okay, speaker, yeah, I've heard, I've seen a lot of speakers, right? Sometimes your brain, you can be a jerk. At least mine can. And I was like, let's hear what this guy has to say. And he starts talking, and my jaw hit the floor. I was like, oh my gosh, his story is incredible. Such a neat, charismatic, articulate, loving dude. And I think I can say this. He's a badass. I think I'm allowed to say that. I mean, by FCC. I know that our guests will not mind. So let me set this up a little bit, because this is a show. I'm already like 20 minutes deep in the setup. This is a show that we could do, you know, a whole series on this amazing gentleman. But I'll just give you a little bit, and then we'll get into it. He's been on some TV shows. I'll let him tell you more about that. He's won some awards. He was a special agent and worked for the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And then there's another letter on the end of there, I forget, but we won't worry about that. And literally, this gentleman did incredible things going undercover that are just mind-boggling. So I'm not going to say any more, but he is a New York Times best-selling author. And some of my friends have seen him on TV shows they love, but I'm not going to divulge that at this moment. I'm going to say now, welcome to the show, to Rock to Recovery Radio, Jay Dobbin. What's up, Jay?
Right on, Wes. Thanks for having me, and hello to your audience.
Yeah. Were you like, dude, shut up and just let's go? I'm just kidding. So, thanks for joining us, Jay. Super stoked to have you.
Thanks for having me, man. I'm flattered to be here. And especially to your audience out there, like you said in your intro, you know, and people out there listening who are struggling, man, you're not alone. You're not alone. That's the message. I mean, just listening to your intro, that was my takeaway, man. You're not alone. You might feel like it, man, but you're not. So
you're not.
Turn your radio up, man, and let's see if we can figure some things out.
Let's see if we can figure some things out. Absolutely. Well, I'm stoked you're here. And so let's get right to it. You know, usually we follow kind of like what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, format in the interview. So, you know, we talk about it every week. Somebody may have stuff in their childhood that they think is relevant to their story. Other people don't. You know, for you, Jay, where does your story start?
Well, the big picture of it, you know, like when I was a kid, I thought I was going to be a football player.
Yeah.
Played football in college, had a successful college football career, tried to play professional football, just flat out wasn't good enough. Right.
I left that part out, and that was in your story. Yeah, yeah. I remember you shared that you weren't like the fastest or the biggest or the toughest, but your heart was such that you literally got a college scholarship, yeah?
Well, you know, I think like everybody that goes through life, our goals change. You know, my goals changed out on a football field where I was basically told in so many words, you ain't going to make it, kid. You ain't good enough. Okay, well, you know what? You better have a plan B in your life. I didn't even have a plan B. I had put everything into that. So I had to invent a plan B. And my plan B was I became a federal agent.
Wow. So, but was I correct in saying you got a college scholarship for football?
I did. Yeah, I played football at Arizona, University of Arizona, on some very good teams. I played with some very, very good players and against some very good players. I mean, I played against guys who ultimately turned out to be NFL Hall of Famers. You know, I played against John Elway when he was at Stanford.
Nice.
Played against Marcus Allen when he was at USC. Played against Mike Singletary when he was at Baylor.
Mm.
Played against Derek Dickerson at SMU. Some of the all-time best people, players to ever put on cleats and shoulder pads. Like, I was at least on the field with those cats.
Yeah, yeah. And you were a tight end, am I correct?
I was a wide receiver.
Wide receiver. Okay, cool.
I was a wide receiver. I look like a tight end now because over the last 40 years I've eaten my way into a three-point stance, but back then I was skinny.
That's cool. So the reason I wanted to kind of stop there for just a second is because we were saying, like, well, you need a plan B. But let's be clear that plan A, I know guys who I looked up to who are really, like, incredible athletes that couldn't get college scholarships, and you did. That's
well,
impressive.
Tell you what, you better be. You have to be beyond good. You have
right.
to be beyond talented. You have to be lucky and healthy as well. And there's things that elements in that game, in that process,
yeah.
that are out of your control. And I think that, you know, we'll probably talk about that. Control what you can control. And don't worry about what you can't control because you can't control it.
The serenity prayer, right?
Yeah, right on.
Pretty much, yeah. So that's cool. So plan A got you in college. I just got to ask you, though, if you're a wide receiver and you played against Singletary, you guys must have gone head-to-head a little bit, or at least head-to-head.
Yeah, I was a possession receiver. You know, I caught balls over the middle. So my specialty was to get open, catch the ball, and then someone else would come up and knock me out, and I would get on their highlight tape for a big hit. That was, you know, when anybody played against me, they were like, oh, I'm going to get a chance to wipe this dude out because he can't get away from me. Make sure the cameras are rolling because I want to be on ESPN.
Yeah, I think I remember that from your story as well. You got knocked out a few times.
Yeah, more than a few. You know, I have all those prerequisites for CTE, which we keep hearing about in the news mm-hmm. as a health issue for football. I mean, I had, you know, a dozen concussions over the course of my career and my lifetime, and I have all the symptomology of it. And you know what? There's nothing they can do for it. So, you know, you're aware of it. I think that for any of us that deal with issues in our life, they're much easier to deal with when you're aware of them than when it's a mystery to you.
Sure. Get the diagnosis. You can't fix a car if you don't know what's wrong with it. Or
absolutely.
Whatever. Right. So, and at that time, you know, they're hypersensitive to concussions now. At that time, I'm going to guess that there was probably times you got knocked out and went and played some more.
Well, I'll tell you, in that day and age, it was a test of your manhood.
Right.
Now, like, guys are tapping out, and rightfully so, saying, hey, I'm concussed, and I don't want to go back into this game, or I don't want to play again before I'm ready, because I don't want any long-term brain damage. Back when I was playing, you got knocked out, man, if you didn't get up and spit out some blood and get back in the game, you were a sissy.
Yeah.
And no one wanted to be a sissy, so you played through it.
That's right. Or you could lose your job, right? If you don't go play, then they bring up the other guy. He does well, and maybe you're on the bench after that.
You know, the worst thing you can say to an athlete, to a federal agent for that matter, the worst four-letter word you can use is soft, S-O-F-T. Mm. No one ever wants to be called soft.
Yeah, and it's a constant test of that. Wow, so you know, plan A, you are a tough guy. You did well, and so you're in college, and when did you come up with plan B to go be a special agent?
At the time, for many of your listeners, they're not familiar with Miami Vice, the television show. They might be familiar with the movie. I'm not talking about Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx, the movie. I'm talking about the old school TV show.
Yeah.
So I saw Sonny Crockett, man, and he's like wearing this Hugo Boss suit, driving a Lambo around South Beach. You know, he's meeting with kingpins at these mansions.
Yep.
And they're negotiating for a ton of cocaine that's sitting on some barge out in Miami Harbor, and there's these beautiful stripper models bringing them martinis, and they're smoking cigarettes. And I was like, man, I can do that. I can do that. Once I got in it, I realized Hollywood had run a game on me. It was a hoax. That's not the life. You know, that Hugo Boss suit, it was a pair of cutoff camos and a wife beater t-shirt and flip-flops. You know, the Lambo was an 83 Malibu that barely ran.
Wow.
You know, the mansion that Sonny Crockett was meeting at, it was a broke down trailer park. You know, that kingpin was some guy sitting at the end of a bar, you know, with his plumber's crack hanging out, who didn't have two nickels to rub together to buy his next bag.
Mm-hmm.
It was much different than what television had led me to believe it was going to be. But in spite of all that, I loved it, man. I loved what I was doing. I loved when my alarm clock went off in the morning. I loved putting my feet on the ground. I was excited to go to work every day. Even on the bad days, I was excited to go to work.
Hmm. I mean, no fear. I mean, sure, you're playing football. That's one kind of tough, going over the middle and knowing you're going to get clocked helmet to helmet or whatever. But how, I mean, you realize you're going to go into a career and it's, you know, there's live loaded guns and people are getting taken out all the time.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, my I get hired on a Monday. Mm-hmm. On a Thursday, 4 days later, I got taken hostage and I was shot.
Taken hostage?
Bullet was fired into my back, went through my lung, narrowly missed my heart, exited my chest. You know, 4 days on the job, I was bleeding out in a trailer park with blood coming out of my chest like you're holding your thumb over the end of a garden hose.
My God.
And I was like, man, I don't remember this episode of Miami Vice. I don't remember Sonny Crockett getting smoked right off the bat.
No. Did you think you were going to die?
You know, with the feds, I was pretty confident of it, to be honest with you. I looked down and pulled my shirt out. I had a hole in the front of my chest, like above my heart, where I knew my heart was. I knew the bullet went in the back. You know, and with the feds, we get paid every 2 weeks. I hadn't even gotten a paycheck yet.
Yeah,
it was just like I didn't even, there wasn't even a deposit in my bank account yet. I hadn't gotten a single penny from the government. This way was on the house. I comped from that one.
Yeah, that's insane. So what's going, you know, how can you set this up a little bit? What happened? Like, did something go wrong? Did somebody mess up? How did that all go down?
Somebody messed up. It was me that messed up. I was brand new on the job. I didn't know what we were doing. We were in an arrest scenario. A guy that we're trying to arrest takes off running, and I chased him. And although I wasn't fast enough to play football in the NFL, I was faster than most cops, right? So, like, I run this dude down, and one thing leads to another, and he's got a gun held to my head. So when you say, like, well, did somebody mess up? Yeah, I messed up.
Would the protocol have been to let a guy like that go?
Not to let him go, but to be smart enough to know what you're doing when you confront him.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have any training. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just, like, I felt like I was the toughest guy on the street. You know, I would go toe-to-toe with anybody. Hmm. And I realized that when you got a 140-pound drug addict with a gun to your head hanging on your back, guess what? You know what? You're not the toughest guy on the street. That gun is a great equalizer.
Yep, absolutely. Wow. So he pulled the gun on you. You weren't ready. He had it to your head. And
yeah.
Then what happened?
The he pushes me inside a vehicle that was there. My partners arrive on the scene, and he's telling me to drive away, basically help him escape.
Right.
And I knew at that moment. I mean, I still had the clarity at that moment. I believed I was going to be. I was going to get tore up in this situation, but I thought, like, if it's going to go down, it's going down right here with my people and my partners around me, not 20 miles down the road where this guy can smoke me and kick me out of the car into a ditch and take off on his own. And I pulled the keys out of the ignition and dropped them on the floor and said, dude, sorry, man, you know, we ain't going nowhere.
Wow.
And then, man, it was like, take the most wicked shootout you can imagine from Hollywood. Take one of those shootouts from, say, like Reservoir Dogs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Take a Tony Scott movie shootout, and then times that times a billion, and that's what took place inside that car. In the course of probably 5 seconds, I think there was 25 or 30 rounds fired, all from every different direction, at me, into the car. It was short-term chaos.
So it sounds like they were okay with losing you to get him if they're shooting into the car and they know it's you and him in there.
You know, I think it was a very desperate situation, and that is not unusual for first responders to be confronted with. Desperate situations where you have to make on the spot life and death decisions.
Sure.
And everybody that was there with me, I think, made the right decision. I think they performed remarkably well. They saved my life.
Yeah.
And I have zero complaints or zero criticisms of anything that anybody did there to save me.
Sure, sure. I mean, and it, you know, we love in hindsight to go back and go, well, why did so-and-so do this and that? It's like, come on, you know, it's split seconds, bullets flying.
You know, I'll tell you what, man, through life's experiences, I'm not an excuse guy. I don't blame people for the things in my life that I don't like. I try not to make excuses for the things in my life that I don't like. I own them, and I own that situation. I was responsible for it. It didn't work out very well on the short term. It worked out fine on the long term. It didn't work out very well on the short term. Luckily, I was surrounded by some really talented people, and they made up for my mistake, and I'm blessed for that.
And you're still here. So you got shot. Blood's spurting out, as you put it, and somehow you survived, huh? They took you to the hospital. What was running through your head when you're bleeding like that, and you think it's your final?
Well,
moments?
You know, I was in and out of consciousness, and yeah. I was leaking, but bad, man. I was wet with blood. You know, when I get to the hospital and they put me on a gurney, and the first doctor approaches and he's like, you know what, we've got like a pneumothorax, a deflated lung, and we've got a through-and-through bullet wound, and do this and do that. And the nurse that's pushing me, I look up at her, and I asked, man, am I going to make it? And she looked down, and she said, baby, we don't know yet. And I was like, man, wrong answer.
Yeah.
Just lie to me right now.
Yeah.
Just lie to me.
Come on, girl.
Just lie to me. Tell me what I want to hear.
You're going to be all right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. Insane. Now, do you have a wife and kids at this point?
I had no kids, and I was married to my first wife.
Gotcha.
Who was like a very sweet, lovely, just a really cool girl.
Mm-hmm.
And that event ultimately proved to be too much for her. You know, like, she basically said to me, like, well, what are we going to do now? And I was like, what do you mean? What are we going to do now? I'm going back to work.
Yeah.
And she's like, man, I cannot do this again.
Yeah.
And I was like, but this is what I have to do.
Yep. You had a calling. You had a calling.
You know what? There's probably not a whole lot of professions or things out there in life that I would have been very good at. This turned out to be one of them. But if I wasn't working as an undercover agent, man, I honestly don't know what I would do. I honestly don't know what I would have been doing.
Why do you think you wanted to do that so bad? Just that it was, I guess, the TV show, huh? You just had such. But I mean, now you're in it. The fantasy's over. I mean, I get it almost more that you don't quit. It's interesting to me because it just seems like you had a calling, like a divine calling.
I grew up in a blue collar family. My mm-hmm. dad was a carpenter and pounded nails for 60 years. My mom was a house cleaner. My mom scrubbed toilets for a living for people that didn't want to scrub their own toilets. They mm-hmm. never chased a penny. They never chased a dollar. They were like hardworking, like do something that helps other people. And that was embedded in me from when I was a kid. I never chased money. I was never interested in money. I wanted to do something that would help other people and ultimately evolved to a position and a profession that I was like so honored to be in because like I looked at myself as someone who stood in between the good and innocent people in our communities who wanted to live a safe and peaceful life and the predators out there who were trying to ruin that.
That's amazing.
I'd never really been good at anything in my life other than standing up to a bully, and that's what I was doing.
I love it. I love hearing the heart and the passion that you have for it. That's beautiful, and thank you, and thank God for people like you. And these are like the heroes that we never hear about, you know, ever. It's going on in cities and all over America. You're never going to hear about Officer Johnson, you know. Rarely.
Yeah, you don't. You know what? And it's the nature of our culture. It's the nature of how we receive information in social media.
Yeah.
You know, for like, are there bad police events that take place out there? Yes, there are. Are there dirty cops out there? Yes, there are. Are there people that make mistakes? Yes, sure. You know, and when those things happen, we should know about them and we should take the proper steps to correct them. But for every one of those, for every one of these events that's in the media, there's another 100,000 potentially violent confrontations that take place across the country during the course of the day that are resolved peacefully that no one ever hears about.
Right. You don't hear about everything that goes right. Yeah, right. I love it. It's a great.
There's bad apples out there, man. There's bad apples in any profession. The
bad
law enforcement world's no different.
Yeah.
Anywhere. But in my experience, having done this for 27 years and now, you know, having 30-plus years involved and associated with law enforcement, man, I literally can name maybe two or three guys who were outwardly corrupt and bad people who did not deserve to have a badge or a gun.
Right.
And those people are no longer on the job. They never should have been on the job. They were an embarrassment and an insult to the profession. And every good cop out there wants to eliminate those type of people from the profession.
Yeah, I believe it. I totally believe it. There's bad people everywhere. That I've always thought that. Teachers, doesn't matter, you know. And we get focused on, hyper-focused on a certain group, and then it feels like, oh, there's too many bad of these. But it's like, it's just kind of...
You know, I'll tell you what, man. The other side of that is that having spent so much time embedded in the criminal community, right, and in people around and with people who were doing some very vile things, right, even in bad people, you can find goodness there, too. So
sure.
The coin is on the other side, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, I know some guys who did some wicked, wicked stuff. And there was points in my interaction with them where I saw some goodness in them.
Yeah.
I saw redeeming, like, personality traits and characteristics where I would think, like, man, you're better than this dude. Mm-hmm. You're better than this. You're better than this life you're living. So it goes both ways.
Sure. Yep. So, Jay, what happens? In the hospital, you recover. How long are you in the hospital before you get back to getting on your feet and on the street?
I was in the hospital for a couple weeks. I had an amazing medical staff. And to be honest with you, I couldn't wait to get back to work. I wanted to go back to work before I was cleared to go back to work. I actually went back to work before the doctors said, mm-hmm. you're clear to go back to work. I couldn't wait to get back. I was young, and I was a little bit brainwashed in the fact that I was like, man, you know what? I'm bulletproof. I just had a bullet go through my chest, and here I am. Huh. I'm bulletproof, man. I'm invincible. Like, I just want to get back in the game and see if I can do it better the next time.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you, like, were you more scared? Were you more cautious? You got almost more confident, huh? And did you have more animosity, more anger because of that? Were you more focused?
You know what it was? It was a great eye-opener for me to show me how at times wicked the streets can be, at times how brutal and violent people can be to one another. But man, that was a great education. There was no better way to learn that than going through what I did. I look back at being shot as probably short of my kids being born as the best thing that ever happened to me.
Wow.
I wouldn't trade it for a world. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I wouldn't skip that event in my life for anything, because nothing short of the event itself, everything after that has been good. And a lot of it is attributed to that single event.
Hmm. When I hear people speak like that after tragic events, to me it's like you can't do that without spirituality or connecting to the greater good, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like turning it into a positive and seeing it in that light, that's a connected mindset, you know?
Regardless of what or who you believe in, for me, I've always been a Christian. And I've always known that especially on the job and the assignments I took, that God had his hand on my shoulder. There's absolutely no explanation for surviving some of the events that I went through without that as the reason.
I love it. So check it out. Let's throw in our break here, the first song that you picked. We have so much to get to. We got to get into how you got – now, that was special – that was a special agent time?
Yes. Right. Yeah, that was my title, correct.
Right. So now, next we'll get into the ATF stuff and all that craziness. But we're going to play your song now. Do you remember what the first song was you picked?
Was it the Goo Goo Dolls song?
Yeah, Goo Goo Dolls.
Yeah, right on, man.
So
that song was ringing in my head, man. Ringing in my head during that time.
What?
The lyrics of that song are...
So it's the lyrics?
Right on.
Okay, what about them? You want to set it up a little bit?
Well, that song was very popular and was playing a lot during my time spent with the Hells Angels. And there's a lyric from it that, like, always burned in my head. And I think it's something like, I don't want the world to see me because I don't think they'll understand. When everything's meant to be broken, I just want you to know who I am. And I don't know if I got that exactly right, but that was like when I'm living this false persona and this bluff and this lie and interacting with people and trying to believe and make them believe that I'm something I'm not. Every time that song came in, man, it was like frying right into my brain.
It was all too real. So we're here with Jay Dobbin. He's telling this story, going from special agent, getting shot in the chest, somehow surviving. He transitions to work for the ATF and go undercover, infiltrating the Hells Angels. We'll be right back to hear some more of his story right after. This is the Goo Goo Dolls on KX 93.5 FM.
forever to touch you, 'cause I know that you feel me somehow. You're the closest to heaven that I'll ever be, and I don't wanna go home right now. And all I can taste is this moment, and all I can breathe is your life. And sooner or later it's over, I just don't wanna miss you tonight. And I don't want the world to see me, 'cause I don't think that they'd understand. When everything's made to be broken, I just want you to know who I am. And you can't fight the tears that ain't coming, or the moment of truth in your lies. When everything feels like the movies, yeah, you bleed just to know you're alive. And I don't want the world to see me, 'cause I don't think they'd understand. When everything's made to be broken, I just want you to know who I am.
I totally get it. I totally get it, Jay. So we're right back here on Rock to Recovery Radio. I am your host, Wes Gear. We are on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM, human-crafted radio, also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. We are here with Jay Dobbin, who's just super rad, amazing, heroic, incredible. I mean, the story is just mind-bogglingly badass. I don't know what, I'm not even using any of the right words. It's mind-boggling. So we have this gentleman, for those of you tuning in now, who wanted to be a pro football star. He got a college scholarship, kicked butt pretty good in my take of all of that. And decides plan A isn't going so well, and somehow I feel like you had a calling to go in, and you were called by my the Miami Vice lifestyle to go be a special agent in Miami. And what was it, your third day on the job, fourth day on the job?
Yeah, my fourth day.
Get in a major shootout, pretty much think you're going to die, take one in the back, comes out through your heart, blood, go into the hospital. Wife can't hang with that lifestyle. Somehow, miraculously, you live, and you couldn't wait to get back on the job. And I loved what you said, that you wanted to go have a life of service and help people and be that buffer, for lack of a better word, between, you know, normal population and all the evil that goes on in the world with drugs and drug dealers, et cetera, yeah?
You know, your praise of me is very kind, and I appreciate that.
You don't like
the
it.
Truth is, the truth is that I'm a common man, and I was put in some uncommon situations and happened to survive them, and many times survived them because I had talented people around me. And so, like I said, the praise is kind, and I appreciate it, and I thank you for that. But
Jay,
I think one of the things, I don't judge people. The people I worked on, the people that I was responsible for incarcerating, I don't judge anybody because I'm the biggest train wreck I've ever met. I'm not in a position to judge anybody.
And we'll get into that. I think you're super humble, but I, from the outside, somebody who does what you do, I can't call that common. But I love that you praise and share, you know, and acknowledge the talents of the people who keep you alive, and that's wonderful. We obviously don't need to get into a debate here, but I think you're a pretty special dude. So tell me, and thank you for what you do, and thank you for being so humble. It's a very beautiful quality of you, sir. But tell us now, how did you get into the ATF, and how did it come that you wanted to do that? A transition, and well, I mean, we kind of know how you wanted to do it, but then I was reading on your wiki, and it said that there was a shootout in Las Vegas, right? So can you lead us
Correct.
Into that transition and how suddenly you find yourself going, I'm going to go pretend I want to be in the Hells Angels?
Well, I joined ATF because I wanted to be an undercover agent. And ATF had the most dynamic undercover program in federal law enforcement. And so I knew that's where I wanted to be. So leading up to this Hell's Angels case, I had 15 years of undercover experience and developing tradecraft and expertise that prepared me for that. I had done everything from buying 38 Saturday Night Special heaters to soldier-launched missiles. Hmm. You know, I had bought everything from street dope to cartel dope. I had done explosive cases, everything from some pipe bombs some guy was making on his workbench in his garage, you know, up to remote-controlled C4 devices. I had done home invasion investigations and murder-for-hire investigations and syndicate and gang infiltrations. You know, over the course of my career, I had 500... undercover operations that I was a part of.
Wow.
So the Hells Angels get into this massive shootout with the Mongols Motorcycle Club at the Harris Casino in Laughlin, Nevada in April of 2002. And the Hells Angels, like, their violence had been unchecked. They were in a real life, almost daily blood battle. Mm-hmm. And ATF and the case agent I work for, a guy named Joe Slatella, said, we got to do something about it, and he wanted me to lead this undercover infiltration. And to be quite honest, when he asked me to, I said, man, I think there's better people for this. I'm not a biker investigator. I played this white trash, like, Peckerwood hitman. That was the role I played. A debt collector. I'm like, I'm not a biker investigator. I named him 10 guys who I thought would be better in that role than I was.
Huh.
And he was like, but I want you to try. I think you can do it. And
wow.
Whether it be to my credit or be to my demise, I was always willing to try. I was always willing to accept cases that and assignments that nobody else wanted.
Do you know what he saw in you that made him want to pick you, even though it wasn't your typical scenario?
You know, in conversations with him afterwards, I think he just thought I was a knucklehead. I think he thought I was, like, crazy enough to do it, crazy enough to say yes.
Yeah. And you got to act kind of crazy while you're in there, right? I mean, it's got to be kind of part of the persona, huh?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, you're surrounded by people that they're not necessarily book smart, like formally educated people, but they have PhDs in violence and intimidation and street smarts.
Yeah.
And you're not playing on the normal level of IQ or intellect that you are in society. You're playing in their world, and you better be able to survive and function and thrive and pass in their world. They don't care about what's taking place outside their world. They own that world. They dominate it. They're the kings of the mountain. And you either fit in or you get kicked out.
Right. It's insane. It's insane. So you pretended you were with a different motor club and were trying to get in.
Yeah. You know, what we did is, within one investigation, there was actually two infiltrations. We infiltrated a gang, a motorcycle gang that was based in Mexico, not to investigate their crimes, because they were committing crimes. We used that association to gain credibility in the eyes of the Hells Angels that we weren't complete outsiders.
Yeah.
So within one investigation, there was actually two major infiltrations that took place.
Which worked out later, if I'm tracking correctly for you, right? Because didn't you have to use the guy who was pretending to be in the Mongols, I think, to stage his death?
Well, ultimately, through the course of, you know, this case ran about 2 years of daily, nonstop interaction with the suspects. Like I'm talking 16, 18, 20-hour days, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year.
And you're acting like a prospect, which for people who don't know, and I'm not the, you know, the guy with the most knowledge on this, but you're basically at their whim trying to prove yourself. Whatever they tell you to do, you got to do it at their beck and call so you can get the jacket, yeah?
Absolutely. In the common man's world, I was a trainee. I was being tested and trained and brainwashed for the ultimate assessment of the gang's members to decide if I was worthy of being a full member.
I gotta ask.
You're a step and fetch. I was a step and fetch.
I feel like, and that's putting it, that sounds nice to me, almost step and fetch. Because I got to ask, and you don't have to say this, or you can give me a lesser version, but like, what was one of the things, because... You know, you have a heart and a soul, you're a human, but I'm thinking that they're trying to get you to do stuff to prove your manhood in a variety of ways. What's something, if you wouldn't mind sharing, that you had to do where it's like, man, I can't...
Oh, there's so many events. There's assaults taking place,
sure.
Right? They'd be beating someone down. Well, as a lawman, I can't stand by and watch some guy get his head caved in, and then come out of that with the excuse of, like, I didn't want to blow my cover. I can't watch that take place. So what I would do in those situations is fight my way to the middle of the fight, get the victim's head, throw a couple legitimate punches on him. I had to stay believable.
Yeah.
But in reality, what I was doing is I was protecting that victim's head so that he wasn't going to catch a steel-toed boot in the forehead and end up dead or with... some kind of irreversible brain damage.
Yeah. Because you got to look like the guy who wants it the most and the willing to get the most dirty. Like, hey, you guys, look at me. I'm in the middle of this thing. You can't say.
Well, I mean, and that was the whole ruse. The whole scam is to make them, like, my objective was to make them want me. Like, you don't show up at these guys' clubhouse and knock on the door and say, hey, man, I'd like to be a Hell's Angel. Can I fill out an application?
Right.
I didn't want them to feel like I wanted in. I wanted them to want to bring me in. I was playing the prom queen to some extent. I wanted them to chase me, and I had to do things and show them things that made them want me to be a part of their gang versus me asking him in. I wanted to be asked in.
Huh. Yeah. Now, what about addiction, drugs, things like that? What's going on? And what's going on with the married life? Because I know at some point you ended up getting married again and having children.
I did. I had, at this point in life, I had two young kids. My wife, I had been married to for several years at that point. Man, I'll tell you what, during the course of my career, of this life, of this Hell's Angels case, I put so much battle damage on my family that it's shameful. It's humiliating to say, and it's humiliating to tell that story to an open audience when there's people out there who are listening who don't know me, who are it's the human nature to pass judgment on things. I get that. But to be honest with you, I became so absorbed in that assignment and so immersed in that role that I abandoned my family and betrayed my family in exchange for that investigation. And that is that's a humiliating thing to admit, especially to an open audience like this. But if me and you are having this conversation and people are listening and I'm not telling the truth, then I have no credibility.
Sure.
So I have to tell the truth. It's humiliating to tell that story. Around these gang members and working towards this case became more important to me than my own family was at that time. And that's a dangerous place to be.
I mean, I feel your hurt and your pain and your remorse over that. And, you know, what comes to mind is like method actors. Like, you know, you're so entrenched in the role it overtakes you, but you're going to die if you're not that entrenched. I mean,
you know,
I get it. I'm not making excuses for you, but you could see why somebody would get so absorbed by
this. You know what? There is no excuse. But, you know, I would come home and my wife, I would come home and I would be in that role. And my wife would say, "You cannot come into this house. You cannot show up here randomly on occasion when you feel like it and treat us like we're gang members."
Mm.
And my response, my self-defense was, "I can't turn this on and off. I'm not a light switch. I can't be husband and dad here and then be gangster on the street and go back and forth. I can't do it. People who dabble in what I'm doing get killed. I have to be all in. I'm not a light switch." And then her response was, "When you come to this house, you better install a dimmer and turn that down because it ain't flying here."
Hmm. Yeah. Heavy stuff, man. I get it. I mean, I get it? I can only try to imagine. But in a logical sense, it makes sense. Yeah. I mean, wow. So
people who treat undercover work like a hobby get killed. You're associating with very violent people who do not take well to finding out that they've been tricked or deceived. They don't ask you about it. They don't question you on who you are. When they figure it out, you're going to catch a baseball bat on the back of your head or have a straight razor dragged across your throat. That's the world that I was living in. And so you've got all these pressures. You got pressures to maintain that cover. You got pressures from the gang. You got pressures from your family. You got pressures from the agency. You got your internal pressures to perform. And it is, it's overwhelming. It can be overwhelming.
I mean, to say the least, it's incredible. It's absolutely mind boggling. So were you using drugs? I believe that addiction was part of what helped you come to a bottom in this lifestyle.
I'll tell you what, I was surrounded by drug use during this case.
Yeah.
I was very careful to not cross that line because I would, in essence, become an ineffective witness.
Sure.
In doing that.
Yep.
But I'll also tell you this, and this defeats the stereotype. There were Hell's Angels members who absolutely refused any type of drug. I think we have this stereotype that they're all boozing, they're all crazy, they're all drugged up. Not the case. There were guys that were absolute fitness freaks that, like, you know, ate chicken breasts every 3 hours and went to the gym twice a day and wouldn't drink a sip
of
alcohol.
Is that gluten-free?
Wouldn't put a cigarette in their mouth.
The gluten-free gangster, yeah.
Exactly. So to not be a drug, people say, like, oh, well, you couldn't survive in that world without being a drug user. Actually, you can. Actually, you can.
Sure. So as the story goes, you're a prospect, and you actually, and that was, you were the first ever to actually become officially a Hell's Angel, meaning you succeeded. You fooled these people. I mean, that's incredible. How does it go from there? And I remember in your story when I heard you before, you hit a bottom and you came to that realization and you started changing some stuff in your life where your values had been off and you wanted to kind of make a living amends to your family. Can you take us through that? We've got about we got about 8 minutes left, and I just want to make sure we get to that amazing part that almost had me in tears when I heard you speak.
Sure. You know, I in essence had destroyed my family. And I came out of this, and I wanted a parade. I wanted praise. I wanted trophies. I wanted people to say, man, you did something that everybody thought was impossible.
So you got in, like, and then you got information and were able to convict some people. That was the...
There was a giant roundup, you know, I think we arrested 60 people and charged them with all kinds of federal crimes and seized, you know, drugs and money and bombs and silencers and you know, solved some murders and so all these things, right? So
you wanted the ticker tape parade coming down.
I was feeling really good about myself, right?
Yeah.
I was really thinking that I was somebody. And I looked back on my life for this goal that I had set, and I achieved this goal, and my life was a napalm strike.
Mm.
I had alienated everybody in my life along the way. And then my true identity came out through the court process, and I started getting death and violence threats. Threats were being issued against my kids, threats to kidnap and gang rape my wife, murder contracts were floating around. And it became overwhelming. And, you know, like you talk about the addiction phase, like I sunk into a huge depression. I still have depression issues. I don't shy away from that. I don't, like I'm way past the stigma of admitting that. I have depression issues. I sank into a depression. I was taking pain pills when I didn't have any physical pain. I was drinking like a fish. I was trying to mask this self-destruction that I had created, and I was trying to hide from it. And to the point where maybe some of your listeners can relate to this. I had come to a point in my life where I was going to kill myself.
I get that.
And I was ready to do it, and I was actually in the process of doing it. And it was interrupted by a phone call from my kids. And at that moment...
So when you say interrupted, what exactly was going on? You had a gun in your hand?
I had a gun. I had it all figured out. I was not going to commit suicide and leave my family without an insurance settlement. I had set up a scenario where I was going to... I was going to kill myself, but I was going to make it look like an accident.
Mm.
I was cleaning my gun. I put the cleaning brush in the barrel. I took the magazine out. And left around in the chamber.
Mm.
And ultimately, when that gun went off, when that bullet went off, and it drove that cleaning brush into my head and killed me, any investigator would look at that and say, this wasn't a suicide, this was an accident. This was a guy who wasn't focused on what he was doing. This is a guy who was distracted.
Yeah.
He didn't kill himself. He had a tragic accident. I wanted to make sure that there was an insurance settlement for my family. I didn't want him robbed of that.
Yeah.
And I had the gun between my knees. I had the cleaning rag in my hand. And my phone rang. And it was my kids. And they were happy. And they were like, Daddy, when are you coming home? We need to see you. And I put the gun down. And I realized that the very people that I had abandoned ultimately came to my rescue.
Mm. Yeah. That's love. I'm getting choked up here. That's heavy. If that isn't God, what is? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'll tell you what. During the course of this case, this is a story that a lot of people enjoy. During this Hell's Angels invitation, I would come home, and I would do the bare minimum I had to do to keep my family functioning. I'd mow the grass, pay the bills, pat the kids on the head, have a cup of coffee with my wife. I couldn't wait to get back in the mix. And every time I'd get ready to leave home, my son, who was about 8 years old at the time, would run out in the yard and grab a rock. And he'd say, Dad, here, take this rock. You know. And so for 2 years, he'd given me these rocks, these good luck charms. And I carried them with me. I carried them in the saddlebags of my motorcycle or in my undercover car, my undercover house. I was handing them out to members of our task force, like, hang on to these rocks. Jackie's got these. There's a blessing on these rocks.
Yeah.
So right before the case ends, right before we fake this murder, I'm making my last trip home. Jackie runs out in the yard and hands me a rock. And I'm trying to comfort my son. And I said, you know what, dude, I'm almost done. And all this good luck you've brought me over these years is why I'm still here. And I'm going to be home soon. And he looked at me, and tears started running down his cheeks. And there's this 8-year-old boy standing in the driveway with no shirt, no shoes. And he said, Dad, those aren't for good luck. And my brain couldn't process where it was going. And he said, Dad, those are for you to put in your pocket. And every time you think someone's going to shoot you or hurt you or stab you, push your hand in your pocket and touch that rock, and that's like me being there to help you fight back. And, like, all of a sudden, everything about my life made sense in that most humiliating moment of my life. My job wasn't to be some dynamic undercover operator. My job wasn't to infiltrate the Hell's Angels. My job wasn't to be super cop. My job was to raise good kids, and I had failed them. And I needed an 8-year-old boy to show his 40-plus-year-old father to teach him that lesson. And that's shameful, but I'm glad I learned it.
Incredible. Man, I there's this part of me, I know you wanted to do better, but it doesn't sound like failure. It sounds like your kid was right in line with the right spirit of the universe that he should have been. I mean, I get your remorse and all that. We could go on all night. It's an incredible story. And I got to tell everybody, this is Rock to Recovery Radio. We're here with Jay Dobbin. He's a best-selling author. He has a book out called No Angel, My Harrowing Undercover Journey to the Inner Circle of the Hell's Angels. You can check it out and hear the story in more detail. Jay, we just got a moment left. If you could just give the listeners at home, what do you do to battle the depression, the shame and guilt, to get out of the addiction, what's the key for you today to thrive and feel good?
Well, like for me, coming to understand it, I know what that feeling is. I know when it's arriving, and I understand it now. And I think that for all of us, once you can address it, life really begins on the other side of acknowledging where you're at. And I think for me especially, I'm talking to myself when I say this. I've made a million mistakes in my life, but I've been surrounded by people who've given me a million and one second chances. And there's always that second chance out there for any of us to get it right.
That's right. I love it. I love it. You're never too sick to recover. There's people out there to support you. You always got another chance if you don't die. Jay, I love you, man. This has been incredible. I wish we had more time. We'll have to have you back on the show to talk more if you'll come back and join us.
Wes, thank you for having me, man, and thank you to your listeners for listening in and tolerating me.
We love you.
Really flattered and humbled to have been here.
You're an amazing dude. So this has been Jay Dobbin with Wes Geer, your host on Rock to Recovery Radio on KX 93.5 FM. We're out.
Oh.